Right. Okay, so what about contributions to global biodiversity? That's a really important thing that we'll talk about here in just a second. Also, there are compounds in native plants that we may not be aware of yet that could provide important benefits for our consumption and use. Who cares if native plants disappear? Theoretically, we all should care if native plants disappear because, like I said, the benefits to good old number one are always going to be important. There's always been a question of, do alien plants increase or reduce biodiversity? Because theoretically, at a local scale, non-native plants could actually increase the local diversity of a community. If an introduced plant comes in and adds to the number of species or the species richness at a given site, then you've increased diversity at a site. And so you can actually read articles where people will make the argument that alien plants increase diversity. But it's a scale-dependent question. If you look at global biodiversity, the spread of species that are particularly problematic can actually result in a decrease in global diversity. And that's really important because increased global biodiversity results in an overall increased ecosystem productivity. So that's something to keep in mind. And if you're interested in just reading about diversity and biodiversity overall, E.O. Wilson's written a wonderful book called The Diversity of Life that I recommend that you take a look at. So that's something to read if you want a broader view of the question of global diversity in general. So one noticeable impact of non-native invasive plants in wetland systems is the displacement of native plants through a variety of growth mechanisms. So here I'm going to talk about four primary growth mechanisms or mechanisms for displacing native plants. And that includes mat-forming species like water hyacinth, crowding or out-competing like purple loosestrife would do, smothering, and examples of those in a terrestrial format would be Japanese honeysuckle or kudzu, and then by shading, regeneration, and other species in the understory, and examples of that are a lot of the tree species and privet, other shrub species like that. I've got just a few photos here. Water hyacinth is a really good example of mat-forming species. Purple loosestrife and its competitive role. Kudzu and its mat forming and smothering role, and Melaleuca and its shading role. So in addition to changes to diversity, and sometimes in result of displacing native species, the non-native invasive plants also impact wetlands by changing the local environment. So these species can actually alter the soil nutrient dynamics, and that can be in a variety of different ways. Non-native species can contribute different levels of detritus to the soil from native species, either more or less, and that can result in a variety of different impacts to the soil condition. They can actually contribute in beneficial and detrimental ways. Beneficial examples would be like legumes that can fixate nitrogen. Detrimental impacts would be like Chinese tallow, which is thought to be allelopathic. And so those can impact the soil and the things that can grow there. Hydrology can be altered. If you have species that clog waterways, that can increase or decrease flood frequency and duration. So that's a very important impact to the environment. Depletion of oxygen in the water column is very important. There are species, particularly the submersed aquatic species that we'll talk about here in a minute, that can actually clog up waterways, and then as they die, the detritus in the water column and the sediment builds up, and the increase in decomposition results in lower dissolved oxygen in the water column. And that can result in fish kills, which further contributes to the buildup of organic matter in the system. And so that results in more depleted oxygen. It's a positive reinforcement cycle. Habitat structure is also an important alteration of environmental characteristics. For example, if you have a wetland that is primarily low-growing forbs and all of a sudden purple loosestrife is introduced and it grows this huge colony of large, thick-stemmed species that can change the availability of habitat for local fauna. So those are important impacts to the environmental systems. In addition to that, we have impacts to financial losses caused by invasive plants. And that includes not only losses due to changes in ecosystem functions, but also changes, losses due to changes in the availability of uses for wetland systems. So for example, recreation and commercial fishing can be impacted. Navigation, water quality, and aesthetics can all be impacted. One thing that people may not think too much about is the possibility of property value decline for landowners who have properties that border a waterway that are then infested with an invasive species. Also, there's an incredible amount of money spent in efforts to control the spread of invasive species and to reintroduce native species. And so those two financial losses can really impact the economy. There's something like billions and billions of dollars spent every year to control invasive species. So here are just a couple of examples of money down the drain, so to speak. On the left, that's an example, first of all, of money spent in research and equipment used to control the species. And then on the right, an example of money that you would have to spend, first of all, to remove the plant that's there, but also the potential for property value decline. So how did we get in this position in the first place? Well, part of it is ignorance. A lot of non-native species have actually been intentionally introduced into wetland systems and terrestrial systems. And it's not malicious introduction, it's just introduction because they had particular characteristics that were desirable for the people who introduced them. The ornamental plant industry is particularly, I don't want to point fingers, but they are to blame in a lot of cases for the introduction of a lot of aquatic wetland species. Aquarium enthusiasts are another source of introduction of aquatic species. And then a lot of these species have historical, religious, or cultural uses, either for people in the United States or for people coming into the United States from other cultures who brought the plants with them. Of course, we're not to blame ourselves. There are a lot of environmental reasons that wetland species have been introduced, in particular remediation. The plant here is Iris pseudocorus, that's yellow flag iris. It's been introduced in a lot of wetland systems because of its ability to uptake nutrients very efficiently. So it's been used for sewage treatment, heavy metal sequestration, and that was a huge topic. I remember in the early 90s, I worked for a water gardening company, and we actually sold quite a few of these non-native invasive species. And it's funny, I send the proprietors of that business information on non-native wetlands all the time so that they know not to sell them. But I remember people coming from TVA and asking us, you know, could we sell them large quantities of Iris pseudocorus because they wanted to plant it as on remediation sites, mine reclamation sites and so forth. Of course, there is a lot of unintentional dissemination that occurs. The trade industry is one way. Packing materials are notorious. That's how Microstegium Japan grass was introduced to Knoxville in the first place. It was used as a packaging material for fine china. And it came over, and that's why you see it on the roadsides everywhere you go in Knoxville. Ship ballasts are another famous unintentional trade dispersal mechanism, particularly for wetland plants and wetland animals that are not native. Transfer through luggage and on clothing from people who visit foreign countries can pick up seeds, just like if you were to leave here with beggar's ticks and go to another country. It's very simple to transfer those things. And again, scientists are not without responsibility. When was the last time you thoroughly disinfected your shoes when you left a wetland site and went to another one? We carry invasive species from site to site on our shoes, on our truck tires, on our boats, on our paddles. Loggers carry on their logging equipment invasive species to and from. And then, of course, there are biological mechanisms. Animal transport, particularly bird species, and then wind and water transport. So what makes these species so successful in wetland systems. Most of these species have high reproductive rates. They may reproduce earlier than other species, so they kind of get a head start to gang up. A lot of them are your typical pioneer species. They're able to colonize rapidly. They germinate quickly and they have rapid growth. And typically they will reproduce through multiple means. So most of the invasive species I'll talk about today can reproduce both vegetatively and sexually. And that can make a big difference. There tends to be a lot of genetic variability in the species and a lot of phenotypic plasticity, which means that they're able to adapt in a lot of different scenarios. Most of them are also pest resistant and habitat generalists in the environment in which they occur. So these plants pretty much have it made in terms of surviving wherever they fall. And those are the very characteristics that make them so irresistible to the horticulture industry and other industries. You know, if you're going to, say, Lowe's, and you're looking for something to plant in your front yard, you're going to pick something that you're not going to have to spend a lot of time taking care of, or at least I'm going to pick something that I don't have to water very often, because otherwise it's going to die. And that's what most people look for, and that's what sells. And so it's easy to understand that, you know, a perfect plant, you're looking for something that's easy to grow and it's tolerant to drought and everything else, that it's going to reproduce quickly, it's got luxuriant growth and it's really pretty. You don't have to constantly spray it for pests and so forth. So it's the perfect plant, and that's exactly what that's exactly what invasive species fulfill, is that role. So we know why wetland invasives are capable of being so successful, but what makes a wetland, particular wetland system, susceptible? In a lot of cases, it can be just climatic similarity to the location of the species origin. A lot of species from Central Asia make it over here because we're at a similar latitude, and so they're able to successfully compete with our native species. Disturbance in wetland systems, because soils are often disturbed, can through floodwaters and so forth in floodplains and riparian areas, can just open up a new landscape for these invasives to colonize. Conversely, stability in a wetland system can reduce the ability of native species to grow and germinate and can promote non-native invasive growth. The absence of native predators, because these species are from outside the country, we don't have any native biological control in many cases. The location of a wetland, wetlands that border areas of disturbance or roadsides, may be more susceptible than other wetlands. And then the size of a wetland, perhaps the smaller a wetland is, the more susceptible it will be to edge influences. And in general, wetlands, because they're ecotones and because they cover such a wide range of ecological characteristics, they're susceptible to both upland and lowland species influences. And so you can get invasion by both terrestrial invasives and invasion by aquatic invasives. So they're like doubly susceptible. I'm going to go through some common southern wetland invasive plants. It's very difficult to learn, obviously, identification in the classroom, so we're not going to try to make sure you can leave here and identify these outside, but I do want to go through a few of them and just talk about some of the impacts that these particular species have in wetland environments, and then just some of their defining characteristics. So the first group of plants we're going to go through are the aquatic forbs. Most of these are the submersed or floating wetland plants. And these are all obligate wetland species. So alligator weed, which is on the Tennessee invasive species list, is originally from South America, and it clogs waterways, which limits commercial use. It has the potential to increase floodings in waterways that it invades, and it reduces native plant diversity. It can be anchored in the soil, or it can be a floating plant. Primary identification, it has opposite leaves, which you can see in the middle photo. I don't know how well you can see it, but okay, my little thing's not working.
It may have turned off. You don't use it after a while.
Oh, how do you turn it on?
I'll turn it on for you. You have to actually hit two buttons simultaneously.
Oh, yeah. I work for the government, so I can't hit two buttons at once. All right, so there's the alternate leaf structure. One of the cool things about this plant, not to, you know, not to go promoting the plant, but this, what looks like an individual flower head, is actually a conglomeration of multiple teeny tiny flowers. So that's one little flower in this spike that looks like a flower head. So I thought that was pretty cool. It roots from nodes along the stem, and it reproduces vegetatively from small pieces of the stem. So, you know, let's think about if you were going to, we're going to talk about control methods in a minute, but let's think about if you went out into a wetland system and you're going to control this by chopping it up and trying to suck it out. If it roots vegetatively from nodes along the stem and you go in and you cut this plant all to pieces, you've just given it a million and one more ways to propagate. So that's something important to think about when we get to control mechanisms. Darn it. Water hyacinth is another really common species. This is sold still in lawn and garden stores all over the country. It's at Lowe's, it's at Walmart, it's down the road at Agri-Feed Pet Supply. I've sold many of them. One of the good things is it doesn't really survive well in Tennessee because we're too far north a latitude, so it's not as much a problem in Tennessee. Where it's a real problem is further south in Louisiana, Florida. Horrible problem there. This is a monocot. It spreads vegetatively by stolon, so it actually sends out little baby plants, and then those plants, the attachment dies between the two and they float apart. The leaves are in these little basal rosettes. And then it produces this nice spike, which has some just beautiful hyacinth purple flowers that makes it really, really attractive to people with water gardens. The problem is, this spreads and it fills up a small water garden really fast. And I'm telling you, Granny can't stand to throw out these pretty flowers. So she's going to take them down and she's going to set them loose in the reservoir because everybody else wants to see how pretty these flowers are. She just knows it. And that's what happens, and that's how it ends up released in waterways. It has about 8 to 15 of these purple flowers in a spike. It can also root in the soil or free float. It also can result in dissolved oxygen depletion because these leaf bases, if they're exposed to too much sunlight or too much shade, they die really easily. They'll fall off. And I've been in ponds where it's been really thick with this, and it really mucks up the water fast. So all that detritus results in.
Is the alligator weed in East Tennessee or is
it? West Tennessee.
I think there are some.
Are there some populations there in East Tennessee?
Yeah, there are some occurrences in our reservoirs in East Tennessee.
Incidentally, water hyacinth is considered one of the world's worst weeds. So go figure that it's still available for retail purchase. Hydrilla is another one of what's considered one of the world's worst weeds. This slide, by the way, is not in your online lecture. It got deleted, and so I can give Dr. Gray a new copy if you'd like it in there. Hydrilla can grow, this is a fascinating plant, it can grow an inch a day. So when hydrilla invades ecologically important native submerged species really don't stand a chance. And they're shaded out by the thick mats that this plant can produce. I mean, you can see that's pretty disgusting. Millions of dollars each year are spent on herbicides and mechanical control methods in Florida alone to try and just put it under control, not eradicate it. Just to get it under control. This particular plant, I mean, it's obvious to see that it would impact commercial fisheries and recreation, but it also impacts water flow and clogs irrigation channels, so it's a big problem. It also messes with the dissolved oxygen in the water. This particular plant is also a monocot. It's got profuse branching at the water surface. It's got very small leaves. A lot of these floating submersed plants are really hard to tell apart, so I wouldn't expect you to be able to tell them apart after looking at this, but there are several websites online. University of Florida has a wonderful aquatic plants website where you can go and study the characteristics. And one of the neat things that you can buy from them is a little, it's attached with a little key ring, and it's just a plant ID guide. It's about wallet size. You can stick it in your pocket and carry it with you. And they have a lot of these invasive plants. I think they have a native plant one and an invasive plant one. So that's really good. But it also reproduces sexually and vegetatively, and it's got multiple methods of vegetative reproduction. So it reproduces through tubers, which are right there, but also through these little turions, which are kind of little buds that occur in the axils of the leaves. And so you end up with multiple methods of vegetative propagation along with sexual reproduction. So this plant has a whole lot going for it in terms of being able to spread.
Know if it grows that dense, and now where's this plant from, you know?
Where does it come from?
Yeah.
I don't have that in my notes, and I don't know right off the top of my head, no.
It seems like it grows that dense wherever it comes from.
Wasn't that one of the papers that I sent you, wasn't it?
Was
that hydrilla?
Yeah.
Let's see. It was introduced in 1960, and I was trying to see if it said where it came from.
In general, in wherever they come from, do they normally, are they this expansive, or do they grow in basically monocultures in the tropics, for example, or are there as aggressive plant species down there that basically everybody keeps everybody in check?
The difference is there are biological pests.
Yeah, okay.
There are insects and pathogens that these plants are susceptible to in their native habitat. So that's one of the things we'll talk about when we get to the biological control section.
Most of these plants, I imagine they probably all grow probably on approximately the same latitude globally. Like if they can live at this latitude, they're probably over in China.
Right. That's why we get so many from, right. Yeah, you do. You see, what's interesting is, you know, people think about the non-native invasives in the U.S., and we always joke about how Asia sends all their invasives over here, and now they're sending us lead-based, you know, toys, but that's, anyway. So, but the reality is, they have non-native invasives that have come from the U.S., because our species are at the same latitude and compete very well over there because they don't have biological control mechanisms for our species. So it's very interesting. Dan Simberloff over on the ecology, in the ecology department on the main campus, has some very interesting stories to tell and things about invasive species in other countries that we've sent over there. So it's kind of a back and forth, yeah. Parrot feather is another one of those submerged floating. It's very similar in terms of its effects to hydrilla, except maybe not quite as vicious in its spread. Parrot feather is another one that's currently for sale at most lawn and garden stores for use in home ponds and things like that. It has whorled leaves. Can see right here, and they're finely dissected. So where the other one had just the four leaves that were whorled together, this one actually has five to six leaves, and they're really finely dissected. So you can tell a difference. This particular plant is very easy to tell apart from some of the other milfoil type plants that you'll see. It also has vegetative reproduction, and it does have small flowers, and it's also mat forming. So. Eurasian water milfoil is a big problem. It's a problem here in East Tennessee. It's a problem across the state in all of the reservoirs. It's similar to parrot's feather, similar looking, but its leaves are a little lusher and a little thinner. So if you flip back and forth between the two, you can tell a difference looking at the pictures. It has whorls of 3 to 6 leaves that are also finely dissected. Small red flowers. This is a picture here of the flower. And guess what? It produces sexually and vegetatively. Although this particular plant, the most common form of reproduction is vegetative. This has been called the most troublesome of the non-native water milfoils, and it occurs in almost every U.S. state. So this particular plant has a very wide range. It primarily impacts recreation, fishing, and wildlife, aquatic wildlife. So, and it has in the past been sold as an aquarium plant. Water lettuce is another floating plant similar to water hyacinth that you can find in Lowe's on a regular basis. That's another one that doesn't persist in a latitude as far north as we are, but is really troublesome in the more southern states. This particular plant has been, it's an interesting plant because people disagree about whether or not it's native or non-native. It's been present in Florida since at least the early 1700s, but even though people disagree about its status as a native or non-native plant, it's still a problem in terms of being an invasive plant. You can see here that it has the capabilities to clog up a waterway pretty quickly. It's really particularly a problem in areas where boat navigation is a concern. So, this is a monocot. It's a perennial. It has very characteristic rosette of leaves. It produces, much like the water hyacinth, sends off little baby plants. It also has little pretty cool flowers down towards the base of the stalk. Really tiny. You have to really pull the plant up and look closely at it to find them. But even though it has the flowers, its vegetative reproduction is its primary reproductive means. Giant salvinia is another floating aquatic form. This has been called, I say this about, it seems like I'm saying this about everyone, but this has been called one of the world's most noxious aquatic weeds. This one particular plant is notorious for dominating slow-moving areas. So you won't see this so much in rapidly moving water, but it's very tolerant to environmental stress, which makes it particularly aggressive. Under optimal conditions, I thought this was very interesting. There was a study conducted in 1973 that said that under optimal conditions in a laboratory, this plant doubled in size every 2 to 4 days. The colony of plant doubled in size every 2 to 4 days. Under favorable natural conditions, the biomass doubles about every 1 week to 10 days. That's pretty impressive spread for this plant. It's like you go out of town for a week and you come back. It says one single plant has been described to cover 40 square miles in 3 months. And that's from a study in 1992. This is a true fern, a true aquatic fern. It's leaves are about 1.5 to 1.5 inch. And the cool thing about this plant is these little papillae on the surface of the plant, you can kind of see them in this illustration up here. They look like little egg beaters. So it sticks up and it's got four little tiny hairs that come together in the center, and it looks like a little egg beater. And what those are there for is to protect the plant from water. So when water falls on that, it distributes the surface area of the water and supports that bead of water and keeps it from getting into the plant itself. The sporocarps of the fern hang underneath the leaves, but the plant's actually sterile. So the reproduction is vegetative in this plant. It's also rootless. These things are not roots. These are modified leaves and stems. So I thought, I mean, I've got to say, it may be an invasive plant and problem, but it's pretty cool. Water chestnut is another floating plant. It's not an underwater plant, but a floating plant. I remember we called this, when we sold it at the water garden I worked at, we called this water mosaic. And people really dug that. They thought that was pretty cool. This particular plant is very efficient at trapping silt, and so sedimentation can be a big problem where this plant occurs. It also results in a reduction of light that can penetrate the water surface. It reduces the dissolved oxygen levels in the water column, and so that can be a problem for fish. It also doesn't provide much of a food source for waterfowl, so that's a problem. one of the primary characteristics of this plant is its leaf shape and the way the leaves grow out from the stem. It's a rosette of leaves, and these leaves have an inflated petiole, which isn't shown very well in this picture, but I'm trying to see if you can kind of tell right here. You can kind of see it right here. That's what provides the buoyancy for the plant. It has little four-petaled white flowers and then a spiny little nut-like fruit. And actually, apparently, those fruits can be pretty painful. So if you get in the water with one, that's another hazard. I mean, maybe a minor hazard, but apparently they're painful. And it does reproduce sexually. Okay, so moving on to emergent and floodplain herbs, grasses, sedges, and rushes. This is where you get into that ecotone between the terrestrial and the aquatic species. So most of the species here are facultative wetland plants. They're not by any means obligate, and some of them are even facultative upland, if you're familiar with that system of classification. Purple loosestrife has been called the poster child for aquatic invasive weeds before. There are a lot of really interesting articles out there about purple loosestrife, some that argue that it's actually not a problem, some that argue that it's a very big problem. So that's a very interesting plant, and if we have time to get to it, I have some case studies. If not, you might want to just take a look at those case studies online. As it establishes and expands, the common thought is that it outcompetes and displaces native grasses, sedges, and other flowering plants that may provide a higher quality source of nutrition for wildlife. Its highly invasive nature allows it to form dense, homogeneous stands that restrict the native wetland species, including some federally endangered orchid species. So that's a concern. And then it can also change the structure of the wetlands in which it occurs. So that's also a concern. This plant can get really big. It can get up to 10 feet tall. One of the reasons that it's spread so widely is because it has a really, really pretty purple flower, and a lot of people really like it, and that's how it's spread across the U.S. It does have a very wide range. It extends all the way from the southern U.S. up into northern latitudes, so it has a very wide range across the country, and it's on the Tennessee wetlands list. It has a square stem, kind of like mint plants do. Of course, that abundant flowering on the spike. Has opposite or whorled leaves that are in a lanceolate shape, and it can produce 2 to 3 million seeds per year per plant. So, pretty competitive species.
This in the seed bank, I mean, you're probably not going to get rid of
it. You're not, and that's one thing. One of the articles that I had you read was about purple loosestrife control. And it was about drawdowns and purple loosestrife. And that's one of the reasons that I had you read that, was because I believe they did multiple drawdowns, and they did it in the winter, so they were trying to expose the soil to freezing and everything else to try and get the, and even over multiple years during multiple seasons, they were able to reduce the population but not eliminate the plant. And that's one of the problems that you'll find with drawdowns in general, is that it generally takes year after year after year combined with some other method to result in some sort of a control. This is the yellow flag iris that we talked about before, with its use for reclamation sites. This is more of a, this species is difficult to control, kind of like cattail is difficult to control. Once it's there, it tends to expand and just form really dense monocultures. It produces through its rhizomes, and so it spreads underground vegetatively, and those can be pretty difficult to extract from the soil. This is a perennial. It grows in wetland situations, but it's also drought tolerant. So again, you've got that wide range of ability to compete in various situations. It has flat arching leaves, just like any other iris. Large, pale, deep yellow flowers. And it happens to be the only yellow iris that grows in wetlands in the U.S. So that's one way to tell it. It's hard to mistake from anything else. Japanese knotweed is another species that's on the Tennessee invasive weed list. And this is another one that can grow in riparian systems, but can also grow in terrestrial systems. So you can actually find this on the roadside, and I've seen it on the roadside in Tennessee. It spreads very quickly to form dense thickets. The theory is that it excludes native vegetation and alters ecological systems because of changes in structure. It also can survive severe floods, and it's able to really rapidly colonize scoured shores and islands. So that's one reason that it's considered to be a wetland invasive. It is a forb, but it's a shrub-like forb, and it can reach heights of 10 feet. So it's a large plant. It's large with alternate dark green leaves. You can kind of tell that in this first picture here. Small white flowers and panicles, and it reproduces both sexually and vegetatively. Cogan grass is a big one further south of us, and it's starting to come up on the radar on the Tennessee exotic plants list as well, in terms of its potential to invade. Interesting thing about cogan grass is it can invade disturbed systems and then alter the fire regime of fire-driven ecosystems. So this is a big problem in areas of the south that are longleaf systems. One of the interesting things about cogan grass is that when you try to burn it, burning it actually increases its ability to invade. So that makes it even more of a problem. It also, in areas that are prone to, they're fire-dependent ecosystems, because it forms these dense monocultures, once it's dead, or once it's dormant and you set a fire, it can increase the intensity of the fire so that even in systems that are adapted to fire, the fire can be so intense that those species can't survive like they normally would. Cogan grass is a real concern in Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana. It's a colony-forming grass. It can grow up to 6 feet tall. I hear it's a real pain to work in. Large, fuzzy, white seed with a silky-like look. Densely mat forming, and it is also flood and drought tolerant. And it spreads both vegetatively and sexually. It's also got, if it's not flowering, this off-center midrib is helpful in identification. So. Japan grass is one of my favorite plants to talk about because I know more about it than any of the other invasive species. I've done some research on this with Chris in West Tennessee. This is an interesting species. This is the plant that I was telling you came in packaging material and was first introduced in Knoxville. And one of the things, this plant actually looks really harmless when you first see it in the understory of a system. But the problem is when it's released either through canopy removal or through soil disturbance, it can explode and really rapidly outcompete other plants in regeneration in the understory. We did some research in West Tennessee that looked at its impacts on native species diversity and on woody regeneration, and found that in areas where Microstegium had invaded, both species diversity and regeneration were decreased. So it really does have an important impact. What we don't know yet is what happens once the overstory closes up again. It could be that this particular species goes back to being, you know, a small, relatively harmless looking plant in the understory again. So that's something we're interested in. We also had questions about the impact if you were to burn in this system to try and control it, about carbon matting on the forest floor and how that would impact native species reproduction and germination. So that's something that we're interested in looking at some point in the future. This particular plant is pretty easy to tell apart from other grasses. It's real delicate looking. One way to tell it apart from other grasses is this little group of three leaves towards the end of the plant, and it has offset mid veins also. Like I said, you know, when you first see it, if you're in a forest understory, it's only about yay tall, maybe 4 inches. But once it explodes after canopy release, the plant itself can be 4 or 5 feet tall and it falls over. So it forms just these big clumps and mats. It, Go ahead.
Would it small under the four-story? I mean, can the leaves be thinner and everything else, or is that a different variety?
No, they're very thin leaves. I mean, are you talking about narrow wide, width wide,
yeah,
or thickness wide?
Narrow.
Well, I don't know. They're always this kind of oval shape. Yeah.
I'm interested in that plant, and I was reading.
Yeah, Dave's done a lot of work with Microcephalium.
I read one study indicating they only require 15% of photosynthetic reactive radiation for a maximum growth, so the likelihood of getting rid of them in the image was pretty low.
Yeah, it's an interesting plant. It's a C4 plant, which usually means, what that normally means, I don't know if you're familiar with botany, but what that normally means is that it does really well in hot, dry, sun-filled environments. But this particular plant is really rare in that C4 category in that it does really well in a shady understory also. So that makes it, again, a pretty cool plant. Because it gets in there, and the theory is that because it's a C4 plant, apparently it has some mechanisms that enable it to make use of the sun flex that come through the forest canopy in a really efficient manner. And so that enables it to just sort of stay there in the understory and sort of hang out and develop a root system and wait until it's exposed, either through, we found that it can spread really easily if the leaf litter layer is disturbed. And then it can explode in terms of height growth if the canopy is disturbed and sunlight's allowed to reach the forest floor. So it's a really interesting plant.
It has a really scant root system too, so you like kick it down the trail, you think it's going to spread that way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it produces copious seed, millions and millions of seeds. So, you know, you can carry it on your shoes. That's one that easily is carried on your shoes. We don't know much, at least I don't know much, and I haven't found much research about avian use of the plant, of the seeds as a food source. You know, just from a been there and seen it, we tend to see a lot of birds hopping around in it in West Tennessee when we were studying this particular area on Ames Plantation. So, you know, you would think, of course, they could be using that as a structure for nesting or hiding or whatever, but it is possible that they're using that as a food source, so that's one method of transportation. The seeds are also transported by floodwaters pretty frequently, so that's why you see them a lot. You know, you're most likely to see them along trails and along areas, wild game paths, and you see them a lot. You see little patches of it. Floodplain areas where scouring and deposition has resulted in growth. So, I don't know. I haven't looked at that at all. This particular plant. This is an interesting plant. It's kind of strange. The plant itself isn't, but it's weird. The plants database, the USDA plants database, calls this a native plant. And the University of Florida lists multiple benefits that this plant has for wildlife and humans, including an important food source for livestock and traditional uses for basket weaving. I mean, they go on and on about what a wonderful plant it is. But then it's listed on Tennessee's invasive exotic plants list as a nuisance species. A noxious species, and it's listed as a severe threat. It's not even in one of the lower categories. So I put it on here to introduce you to this plant so that you'll be aware of it, but just be aware that in some states it's not considered to be a problematic species.
Isn't there a native Phragmites?
There is a native Phragmites, and apparently it's very difficult in some cases to tell the difference. But this was listed by this particular scientific name on both the Tennessee exotic species list and on the plants database as a native species. So very, very odd, but I put it on here because that happens pretty frequently, so you might as well know about it. This is a tall perennial. It's 15 feet tall or more. It's one of the tallest wetland reeds. It has alternate leaves that are broad and strap-like, pointed, that are up to 2 feet long, 1 inch wide, and these fluffy purple or gray flower heads.
Provides great thermal cover in the winter, especially in northern latitudes. Deer will be in there, pheasants.
I mean, you know, it was interesting to me to read all of the benefits and then find it on the Tennessee invasive plants list. I thought, well, I'll put that on there just because that's interesting.
I'm pretty sure, Michigan considers it an exotic invasive.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the plants in the northern latitudes have it listed as exotic invasives, so. Moving on now to the shrubs and trees, and again, these shrubs are another one of those mostly facultative upland species, and the trees are primarily facultative wetland. So, Chinese privet, I think we're all familiar with this, at least I hope so, and its potential for disturbing the understory. Of course, it can grow very thick in the understory in terrestrial systems and in wetland systems, and can alter the structure of habitat there. It's an evergreen shrub, grows up to 30 feet tall. It can grow in the shade and can grow in the sun, so it's adapted to a wide range of conditions. It has a multiple stem trunk and these opposite oval leaves with the fragrant white flowers, which is one reason that it's spread in the first place, with purple and black fruit. Other non-native privet species are very similar, and a lot of times if you look on invasive plant lists, you'll just see non-native privets listed as opposed to each by its individual name. So, non-native roses, that's similar in terms of terrestrial and aquatic, being both terrestrial and aquatic invasives. You can tell we do have native roses that grow wild in Tennessee and further south. One way to tell the difference in non-native roses like multiflora rose from our native roses is the presence of these fringed bracts at the leaf base. And this has odd pinnately compound leaves with 5 to 9 leaflets, and then of course the cluster of white flowers that identifies it as multiflora rose. Did you have a question?
Is swamp rose included in that? I know it's got that feathery fringed bract.
You know, I'm not sure. If I told you one way or the other, I'd be guessing.
Is it?
Yeah, I could very easily tell.
What did you say?
I just said I'm pretty sure the swamp rose is native.
I think you're right about that. I think you're right about that.
I also had the fruits had little prickly hairs on the spiny hairs. Does the multiflora have that?
I don't think that the multiflora rose hips have hairs.
Yeah, I don't think it is either. That's probably just assuming.
I don't think so. Melaleuca, this is another one of those interesting species. And you were asking earlier about the plants growing, how they grow in their native habitat and so forth. This particular tree is from Australia. And it's interesting because in Australia, it's actually an extremely important plant. And it's an object of conservation efforts in a lot of areas where it's becoming rare. So I think that's really interesting that here it's a big problem and there they're trying to conserve it. It's extremely valuable to beekeepers, birds and bats that are native to Australia. So that's very interesting, but it has no problem growing here. Especially in Florida, this is particularly a problem in the Everglades. It tends to grow quickly and close together and forms really dense stands, and these infestations displace the native vegetation, degrade wildlife habitat, and alter fire regimes in the Everglades. And they also, it elevates soil levels through detrital buildup and so forth, and that affects the water flow. So that's very important. There's a website that's really interesting. If you go and Google T-A-M-E Melaleuca, there are all kinds of bits of information on there that are extremely helpful.
Is this the same plant that they use the oil to make all kinds of healing things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Do you know what part of Australia is native to?
I don't. Well, I mean, I'm sure, though, that if you Google that website, it probably has it on there. It's an evergreen tree. It grows up to 100 feet tall. Of course, it's not surprising that it's evergreen in South Florida. So, it has alternate gray-green leaves, and they have that odor of camphor when crushed. It has the white flowers and bushy spikes right there, and this really distinctive peeling bark. Again, it's one of those species that produces just tons and tons of seeds. So it really grows these dense monocultures of that particular tree. And it's a big problem growing on islands. There's a case study, if we have time, that we can talk about. Chinese tallow is the other tree, wetland tree that I have listed, invasive tree. This is particularly a problem along the coastal plain of Texas, Louisiana, and Florida. This is another tree that's been used for a variety of different products, particularly, I believe, in China is where it's from. This actually can invade a variety of wetland habitats from freshwater to saline water, so that makes it a problem in a lot of different areas. It can produce up to 100,000 seeds, and those seeds can be carried by birds, although we're going to talk in a minute about how some birds, a lot of the common birds like grackles and mockingbirds, eat the seed, but the seeds are toxic to cattle and toxic to insects. So even though it can benefit some of the seed-eating birds and fruit and berry eaters, it's actually a big problem for some neotropical migrants because they're insect eaters and it's allelopathic to insects, so that reduces the availability of insects as a food supply for those species. So it's really an interesting, the case study about the Chinese tallow is very interesting. This is a stump sprouting plant, so even if you go and cut the tree down, it can stump sprout back very quickly and very easily. Once established, it crowds out native species and tends to form monocultures. It's toxic to us in terms of its sap is irritating to the skin, and then both the leaves and the fruit are toxic to cattle and also to us. So that's interesting. A lot of people call this popcorn tree. I don't think I got a good picture of it, but these, when they open up, they look like popcorn. So to talk a little bit about what to do about these plants, there are four primary methods of control for wetland invasive plants. Manual methods, mechanical, biological, and chemical, and then integrated pest management, which is a combination of one or more of those above methods. Like I told you before, I'm not an expert at control of wetland invasives, but I am going to go through some of the different methods and some things that we've learned about how they do and don't work and advantages and disadvantages of each of the methods. Manual removal is pretty self-explanatory. It involves things like raking, hand pulling, and that includes aquatic submerged species. People do attempt to remove aquatic submerged species using scuba gear in deep water scenarios. So people are willing to try about anything. And then hand cutting. Obvious advantages of manual removal is it doesn't take a genius to pull up a plant. So it doesn't require a lot of research dollars. It doesn't require a lot of knowledge. It's easy to use. It's easy to send someone out to do. And generally, the equipment tends to be less expensive than some other methods. It's also environmentally friendly. But, you know, obvious disadvantages, you have to keep at it over time. And it's labor and time intensive, which may increase your overall costs. And, of course, in a large area, it's just not reasonable. I mean, it might be reasonable for a backyard, very small wetland scenario, but it's not going to be reasonable for a reservoir in East Tennessee. Also, some plants are just really hard to pull up, and then the effects on the stirring up the sediment may influence some aquatic, both plant species and animal species. So, A mechanical control refers to the use of some sort of a mechanical means to remove or manage the species in question, and that includes even things like fire and water level manipulation. I've listed some examples here. For submersed aquatic and wetland systems, water level manipulation combined with one of the other mechanical methods or an herbicide seems to be a fairly useful method for managing infestations. So some advantages of mechanical methods. For one thing, it allows for some immediate visual results, and sometimes that can be really important from a public relations standpoint, if for no other reason. Particularly if you're working in an area where recreation is important or open water fishing is important, or perhaps you need immediate open water for waterfowl use. The mechanical method can get you that in a relatively quick amount of time. However, just like the manual methods, mechanical control usually has to be repeated. And some species are difficult to cut, and like I mentioned before with hydrilla, some species will actually reproduce more in response to mechanical cutting methods. So if you're looking at mowing or chopping or disking, you might actually cause more problems than you solve. So that's just something important to keep in mind. Another method of mechanical control that is frequently used in wetland scenarios is water level manipulation. Has the advantage of potentially allowing for the germination of and recolonization of native species in areas that were formerly occupied by exotics. So that's one advantage. And in areas where dissolved oxygen has decreased, you can get multiple advantages through manipulating the water level, because not only are you potentially removing the water source and allowing the plant to die because it doesn't have the water there to support it, but also you're allowing the sediments to be exposed to the air, so decomposition can occur more quickly. And then when you reflood, your oxygen levels are higher. Additionally, sometimes other functions like increase in shorebird habitat might be another reason for manipulating the water level. So sometimes you can sort of kill two birds with one stone. However, water level manipulation does require the equipment necessary to manipulate the water level. And if you don't already have those water control structures on site, that can be a very expensive method for control. Weather events and public relations issues can be a problem. For example, water level manipulation was something that a graduate student here studied several years back in Dr. King's lab, looking at Realfoot Lake and management of some of the aquatic invasives there. And one problem with that is that the public who lived on Realfoot Lake did not want drawdowns of the lake, because that would result in a decrease in their ability not only to enjoy Realfoot, but also they were worried about potential odors involved in decomposition and that sort of thing. A lot of them who had businesses that relied on the lake wouldn't be able to access the lake the way they wanted to, and so that can be a real problem to work around if you're working in a public area. And then some wildlife species might be negatively impacted. And I gave you two of the papers that you read for class about drawdowns. So you can read from that also those articles, the challenges that are associated with using drawdowns to manage invasive species, and that sometimes it doesn't work even when you try very, very hard. So very interesting.
Yeah, and just to add, for example, alligator weed, it can be aquatic. You can draw it down and it can basically start growing and emerging. And so I guess you're going to get to the integrated management.
Right.
Often with a lot of these invasives, you have to use multiple techniques to get rid of the darn things, or at least you may never get rid of them, but at least reduce your coverage.
Right. Prescribed burns are another important method, at least for emerged or floodplain species. In terms of mechanical control, they're cost-effective means for treating large areas of some species, and a means of control that most people who work in management organizations are very familiar with. So it's a familiar method, but it's crucial to understand the life history of the plant. For instance, I mentioned Kogan grass. Fire can promote the growth of Kogan grass, and it can also promote the growth of Melaleuca. So you want to be sure that you're aware of whether or not you're actually going to cause the plant to decline or cause the plant to increase. Seasonal timing is important, and again, you've got the public relations issues that could be associated with that. And then again, multiple treatments are probably going to be necessary. Biological control, I passed out, well, or I made these available. I don't think you got any propaganda, so make sure you get some. this is actually a really cool book, The Biological Control of Invasive Plants in the Eastern United States. And there's a section in there that's dedicated to aquatic invasive plants. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read portions of it, and it is a really good resource. I provided these to you not with the thought that you're going to go home and memorize it all, but hoping that if you're ever one day working for an agency where you might need to know how to control one of these organisms, that this would come in handy as a reference. So it's actually a really neat book. There are several different methods of biological control. There's the herbivorous method, things like grass carp and grazing, and then insects and pathogens. And there are actually a lot of people here at UT that study biological control of invasive species, whether it's invasive plant species or things like the woolly adelgid. Biological control gives you an advantage of ongoing control. So that's a possibility of controlling things over the long term, which is an advantage over some of the other methods. Presumably, once you introduce some form of biological control, it's going to propagate itself. And hopefully you don't have to keep releasing it after a certain amount of time. It also seems to work well with other treatment methods, applying biological control with one of the other treatment methods. However, the development of control methods that work well are extremely expensive because you have to invest time in research to make sure that it's not going to impact species that you don't intend for it to impact. And then investing the money in bringing those over and then disseminating those in public relations, trying to communicate the various impacts and the research results on that. So it's extremely expensive. And then additionally, just like in its native arena, biological control normally doesn't result in the complete elimination of a species. It normally just results in managing the species over the long term. Okay, so we're going to talk about herbicides now, which are admittedly a big weakness of mine. So I'm going to go through this, and I'm going to talk in great detail about some of these herbicides. But there are a lot of really, really good resources out there that tell you a lot about the appropriate application rates for these various herbicides, because it's different in every situation for every species. So, you know, there's no way I could give you a description of these herbicide methods that you could leave here with and know exactly what to do with them. There are four types of herbicides used in aquatic environments. Systemic, which kills the entire plant through uptake in the root system. Non-systemic, which are the contact herbicides, and those just kill the plant, kill the portions of the plant that they come in contact with. What happens is the herbicide damages the cellular structure of the plant, and so it damages the cellular structure of the leaves and the stems and the flowers, and that's the part that dies. However, the roots remain viable, so the plant can regrow. Selective herbicides only affect some of the plants, so that's like your broadleaf herbicides, kind of like Roundup you grow to spray on the weeds in your yard. And then there are broad-spectrum herbicides that affect any plant they come in contact with. Needless to say, I'm sure, there are strict regulations regarding the use of herbicides on aquatic systems. And that includes the possibility of significant damage to human health, the environment, and wildlife resources. And aquatic herbicides are strictly controlled by EPA. Any herbicide that you use in aquatic environment must be approved for EPA use. And most states also have restrictions. Tennessee law requires a special permit for herbicide application to any state or federally managed impoundment in the state. In some cases, you also have to be licensed to apply aquatic herbicides, but that's generally in a case if you were working for an organization or an agency where you'd be contracted out to provide that service. You would have to have a license for the use of that herbicide. You can get permits for application of aquatic herbicides on the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation website. And there's also quite a bit more information there on applicable state laws regarding the use of various chemicals. To effectively use chemicals in aquatic system, of course you have to have knowledge of the plant, the system, and the herbicide. For example, you have to know how the plant is going to respond to a particular herbicide. You have to know the effective concentration levels. Some things you might not think about are the exposure time that's necessary for effective action. Some herbicides require several hours to days to be effective. You also have to be aware of the allowed concentration by EPA. And also, and this relates sort of to the exposure time that's necessary, your system water exchange rate. So if you're working in a system where it's not a closed system, but water's running in and flowing out, you have to be aware of how long it's necessary for the herbicide to react with the plant, and also how long the water is going to be in the system, so that you know that the plant will be exposed to the herbicide for long enough for it to be effective, if that made sense. Some of the different aquatic herbicides that are approved by EPA, there are 7 currently approved by EPA. Glyphosate, which is under the commercial names of Rodeo, Aquamaster, and AquaPro, is a broad-spectrum systemic herbicide, and it's typically used on floating leaf plants or emergent plants. And it's applied to the leaves, but it's not at all effective for underwater species. So, Floridome, which is marketed under the name Sonar and Avast, is a systemic slow-acting pellet or liquid. There are multiple ways to apply some of these herbicides, and it's effective with underwater plants, but not effective for small areas. It really works best if you can apply it in large areas. 2,4-D, which is marketed under the names AquaClean and Navigate, is also granular liquid, and it's fast-acting. It's a selective herbicide, and it's systemic, so it kills the entire plant. It's very useful for water milfoil and other broadleaf species, but it has some restricted use in various states. So, Endothol, which is marketed under the trade name Aquathol, is a non-selective, fast-acting contact herbicide that doesn't kill the roots, but it's used for seasonal control of aquatic plants, particularly small populations. However, it can, fish are sensitive to this particular herbicide, so that's something to keep in mind. Diquat, which is marketed under the name Reward, is a liquid herbicide that's non-selective. It doesn't kill the roots, and it's also useful for small area treatments. A lot of people are familiar with Garlon. Triclopyr is Garlon 3A or Renovate. And it's useful against some of the emergent plants like purple loosestrife. There is a swimming restriction that's a 12-hour restriction when it's used in an aquatic environment. So that's something that you would, those types of things are things you want to consider if you're working like in, you know, one of the reservoirs or something where people are going to be using the waterways. It does also work against water milfoil in the broadleaf aquatics. And then the last approved EPA aquatic herbicide right now is Imazapyr, which is Habitat, and that's used for emergent and floating leaf aquatic plants, but it's not useful for underwater plants. So that's my broad, don't know much about them, but here's the list of aquatic herbicides that EPA has approved. And there are aquatic herbicides that are up for approval every year, so you can check in at the EPA website to find out if any others have been approved for release.
And depending on where it's being released, like for example, are all those approved for federal land?
All of those are approved for any waterway, provided you also meet state regulations. So although those are approved by the EPA for use in any, you know, regulated waterway, the state may not allow use of certain herbicides in certain scenarios. So it gets really complicated because you have to know both the federal regulations and the state regulations.
But TDEC probably would help you with that.
I'm sure they would.
Yeah, as far as what regulations were necessary for Tennessee.
Right, right. I looked at a few different states and their laws, and it seemed like the majority of states accepted the EPA-regulated herbicides without...
They weren't more restricted.
Right, without further restriction. So, integrated pest management, as I mentioned before, and as Matt mentioned, combines several or all of the methods that I've mentioned previously. Some examples might be, for example, if you're looking at something like water hyacinth, you might draw down a wetland, allow the plant roots to kind of dry out, and then apply an herbicide, and then reflood, and see what you get. Or for an invasive tree like Chinese tallow, you might cut the stand and then apply an herbicide to prevent stump sprouting. And then you may have to repeat that as seeds grow. So most of these methods, even with integrated pest management, are going to require multiple attempts, and integrated pest management in general focuses not on eradicating a species, but on managing the invasive at a tolerable level, with the understanding that eradication is probably not reasonable. So, how are we doing on time?
6:40.
Oh, okay. So we need to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to, maybe we can pick maybe one of the case studies to go through.
Okay. Well, let me talk about Chinese tallow because I think it's interesting. And it's first in line, so it's easy to get to. Chinese tallow was introduced in 1772 along the Gulf Coast. It's been used historically for making soap in China, candles, fuel, and also for ethanol, methanol, and as a petroleum substitute. Don't tell anybody because they might want to grow more of it. One of the reasons that it's actually still available in some lawn and garden supply stores further south, and one reason is because it has really attractive fall foliage, so a lot of people really like to look at it. It grows quickly. It's able to spread rapidly because it's reproductive at age 3 and it reproduces for 60 years. So it's got a lot going for it. It's pest resistant and tolerant of flood, drought, shade, sun, and fire. So it's almost like the unkillable species, you know. It's also tolerant of fresh and saline water. But again, like I mentioned before, the berries are toxic and the sap is toxic, and it's thought to be allelopathic. So not only is it able to grow everywhere at a latitude far enough south, but it also prohibits the growth of everything else. So this case study focuses on the Chenier Plain of Texas and Louisiana, which is a series of sandy sort of prairie-like ridges of marsh vegetation that's interspersed with patches of forest. This is significant for a significant area for wintering waterfowl populations, but here what's important is that it's a significant migratory passerine fallout. So in the spring migration, as birds are flying north, this is one of the first areas that they hit after they cross the Gulf of Mexico. And I've been there in the spring when the fallouts hit, and it's absolutely incredible to see all of these neotrops on the Chenier Plain. And so these small forest patches are historically very important for these neotropical migrants, because along the Gulf Coastal Plain, there's some of the taller vegetation are these little forest patches. So Chinese tallow affects the Chenier Plain in a multitude of methods. We actually took a field trip to the Chenier Plain to look not only at the neotropical migrant fallout, but also to look at Chinese tallow and to talk about how it's impacted migratory bird species. Tallow can displace the marsh vegetation, first of all, which can decrease the waterfowl habitat availability. So that's one problem. But it also forms these monocultures, and the berries are toxic to insects. And it's like I said before, a lot of the native bird species that are not insectivorous will eat the seeds, And so it may appear that you have a large diversity of bird species using Chinese tallow, so there may be an argument on one hand that tallow is good habitat for bird species. But these neotropical migrants, when they land in this fallout, they're looking for insects. And the berries are toxic to insects, so that results in a decrease in the food supply for the neotrops that are falling out as they come across the Gulf of Mexico. So you've got all these tired birds that fall out into these tallow forests that are no longer the native forests that these birds are accustomed to landing in, and there's no food source. So basically what you have is an ecological trap or a sink for these neotropical migrant species. So there have been various methods used for Chinese tallow control on the Chenier Plains, and this is an example of an integrated pest management solution. Mechanical control, which has involved removing individual trees in low density areas, so that's just the hand pulling or digging up or whatever method. And then prescribed burning can slow the spread of small stands that haven't established a big thick monoculture, but it's pretty ineffective against high density stands because the fire can't penetrate the stand. And then combining the mechanical means, the cutting and the digging and so forth, with stem injection herbicides. So that's that particular case study. And I think I'm going to wrap it up here since you've got the rest of these. Melaleuca, and this is very interesting, shows the map of the species in the Everglades and describes some of its effects. And then the purple loosestrife, which is very interesting because, like I mentioned, here's a range map of loosestrife in Tennessee. Did somebody ask earlier about that? Or was it a different, it was alligator weed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can see alligator weed, it starts and it goes in East Tennessee right along the Tennessee River Valley and then goes down to the Georgia and Alabama.
Yeah, I'm sure most of y'all know about the UT Herbarium online range maps, but they're great for the only thing to remember about herbarium range maps like this, and even the plants database that a lot of people don't think about, is they are fully dependent on somebody reporting that species, which means that just because it's not here doesn't mean it isn't in all these counties. It just means nobody's handed that sample in yet. So.
Do you have to be like a botanist to report it?
No. If you can identify a plant, or even if you can't, if you make a note of where you found it and you think that it's a particular species, you can take it to the herbarium and they'll identify it and record it. So.
Or if you can take a picture of it, if you call our herbarium, those guys, they just sit around waiting for questions.
Yeah, they do.
They're like, where?
Yeah, they do.
That's what they do on weekends.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much true. So there are some examples in the purple loosestrife case study. You'll want to read through and take a look at the examples and the hypotheses there. I really like looking at purple loosestrife because it points out how the majority of our studies of invasive species are correlative studies. And so we don't know very much about the real impact of invasive species. Most of our understanding comes from correlative studies or observations at this point. We're just now getting to where we've been studying invasive species long enough that we can observe before and after impacts. So that makes it really interesting. And then there's a hydrilla in Lake Martin case study, which is really interesting because this is actually a project that we had to do when I was in this class under Dr. King. He assigned this as a project and got really upset because he assigned it under the name Lake Fake, and we all found out what it was and looked it up. So we spoiled the surprise. but anyway, this is a really cool lake in Louisiana, and I've been there. It's really neat. It's owned by the Nature Conservancy, and it's home to a huge rookery of heron, egret, and spoonbills. I mean, it's just a beautiful place, and it's used for a ton of different things. But hydrilla has really caused a lot of problems with dissolved oxygen rates, and it's a very, very bizarre feedback system. I mean, it gives you an idea of just how complex things are because you've got all this heron rookery, which is a great thing, and everybody's excited about it and wants it there, but birds poop, and all that poop goes into the water, and that combined with the prevalence of hydrilla, well, first of all, that contributes to the growth of hydrilla because you've got all these nutrients in the water. And you've got all those nutrients and you've got the death of the plant in the water, and that lowers the oxygen rate, which results in these fish kills, which lowers the availability of food for the rookery. And it's just this huge mechanism, and that lowers tourism dollars, and it's a mess. And there's also agricultural runoff coming into play, contributing additional nutrients. So it's a really fascinating thing. It's hard to find information on it on the internet. There's just not much out there, but it's very interesting. So you should take a look at that case study. But to wrap things up, I guess one thought is, should we be proactive or reactive in our approach to non-native species? Jim Miller with the Southern Research Station, who wrote the identification, one of the identification guides over there, he's really promoting right now the idea of washing your shoes and washing your equipment in the effort to stop spreading invasive species. And he's promoting that to the scientific community, because if we don't take responsibility, then who's going to? I mean, And we're all guilty. I don't know that I've ever washed my shoes after I've come in from the field. You know, I mean, you don't think about it until somebody points it out. Eradication programs are expensive, so it's hard to decide at which species money should be directed, and then who should decide, and based on what factors. As scientists, what should our role be in invasive species management? Should we be advocators, because as scientists we're usually taught not to advocate one way or another different things, so that's interesting. And then of course there's the question in biological control, should introduced species be used to control introduced species? So that's something interesting to think about. And then invasive species are very difficult to study, and that's, there are limits to hypothesis-driven manipulative studies, because you don't want to go out and plant an invasive species somewhere to see its effects on an area where it wasn't before. And so, you know, those can be very controversial subjects. Even growing invasive species in a lab can be a controversial subject, because then, you know, there's the possibility of tossing it in the trash, and how are you going to destroy the soil and sterilize the soil to make sure the seeds don't reproduce later. So anyway, there are a lot of issues that are related to the research of invasive species. But does anybody have any questions? I know I just talked, so.
Questions for Sonia, a little discussion?
Well, all right.
Okay. So Sonia has a couple readings, as y'all know, that I sent to y'all, and they're also on the website. Make sure to read over those. You're gonna have some questions on the exam over those readings, as well as all the information that she presented today. And thanks a bunch for coming on over. Appreciate it, Sonia.
Sure. Anytime you want to come by the FIA office, doors are open. Come by, meet the different scientists, and find out what we do and what data we've got available. We collect information on invasive plant species, mostly terrestrial, but we do collect information on Chinese tallow, so that's one that's available. Privet, non-native roses, we collect information on. So there's quite a bit of information that we have for each of the states. And so it's a great source for data, and we're really trying to make people aware of it.
Cool.
So.
Right on. Well, thanks a bunch.
Thanks.
And again, just a reminder, 12:45 outside on Sunday. We'll be back about...